I have one thing that I'd like to simply put out as a possibility. I don't really expect that any of you, well, I know that one of you has already indicated that he might be interested in doing this, but we had a technical problem last week in that the lecture did not get recorded. And that's a problem because we are selling this course to people who want to buy the MP3s of the course. So I'm going to have to repeat last week's class. And I can either do it with nobody there, or I could do it with some people there if you felt like you wanted to come and sit for 2 hours and ask further questions on chapter 18. So if anybody wants to do that, you let me know after in the break, and then we'll arrange an acceptable time. And depending on how many want to do it, it might be a really small group, and it would be over in the Lonergan Research Institute Library. There is one thing that we're going to try first. We're going to ask Brian Delicata and one other person to see if they can't recover what might have gotten recorded, but that we can't get the sound, because Greg is pretty clear that it was recording, but for some reason there's no sound out of it. So anyway, I'm just putting that out there. I'm going to have to do it again, because we've promised people that this course will be available on audio. So if anybody, it would be better to have some questions rather than just listening to me, because that's when the dynamic really gets going. But so if anybody is willing to sit through another 2 hours discussing chapter 18, just let me know when we can arrange some for that. But I don't expect anybody. Okay, so we're in question chapter 19 now, the question of God. Lonergan, the point that I mentioned at the end of number one is probably where I'd like to start here. He did say later on, after this, that in keeping with the dynamic of the book, he should have begun the question of God with the issue of religious experience. Because everything so far has been so much concretely rooted in the cognitive and then the moral experience of the subject, that when he's opening on to the question of God, he should have, first of all, done a sounding of the experience that people have had, that experiences that people have had that have opened them on to the possibility of the reality of God. Anyway, he didn't do that, and we're going to cover it the way he did do it. He still, even in this later work, maintained the position on the philosophy of God that's expressed in this chapter. He didn't take that back at all, but he did say that the concreteness of the way that he had been proceeding all through is somewhat interrupted by all of a sudden going off into this what seems like a disjunction from the dynamic movement of the rest of the book. Anyway, it is the question of God that arises in this chapter, and it arises from the fact of evil. It is the problem of evil that gives rise to the question of God, and in particular, the problem with which he ended chapter 18, that it seems that we have no resources within ourselves, imminent in our own development, to meet our incapacity for sustained development. That left to ourselves, we are doomed. Unless there is something further beyond what we have seen so far, at least in the realm of proportionate being, beyond the conjugate forms of physical, chemical, biological, psychological, intellectual, moral reality. There must be something more, or otherwise humanity is doomed, because there is this block in moving from knowing to deciding. The block that he refers to as moral impotence is a gap between our essential freedom and the effective freedom that each one of us actually enjoys. And unless there's something to help us close that gap, something that liberates us into the capacity for self-transcendence, there is going to be a continual frustration of our hopes and desires and our wishes for ourselves and for the human race. There are needed further conjugate forms beyond the intellectual and the moral. And these must be given by a reality that transcends the realm of proportionate being. In chapter 20, those conjugate forms will be the virtues, particularly charity, hope, and faith. And if there is such a higher integration of human living, it will be known only through a knowledge that goes beyond the types of knowledge that we've seen thus far in the book. It will be known by theology. So it goes beyond physics and chemistry and mathematics and biology and psychology and even cognition theory. But also it's continuous with these other forms in its basic characteristics. Theology is not at war with science. I mean, it has been in the course of history, but that's because either science or theology has been misconceived. And obviously from Lonergan's whole approach, there is no conflict between science and theology. One of these characteristics is the distinction between a heuristic structure and its determinations. One of the characteristics of the continuity between this new kind of knowledge and the forms that we've seen already, the distinction between a heuristic structure and its determinations. And so what does that mean for this question? It means that we must first determine, well, what can we know and what do we know about transcendent being prior to the attainment of a real act of understanding that would grasp what transcendent being is. So it's like, let X be the unknown number, and then you work out the properties of X. What do we already know about it? What features must it meet in order to be the number that we need for the solution of a particular equation? So here, what features can we attribute to being that is beyond proportionate being, that is transcendent being? What can we know, and what do we know about it now, even before we've reached an act of understanding into it? And obviously we'll see later that we don't reach that act of understanding. As St. Thomas Aquinas said, we know that God is, but we do not know what. So the problem of evil thus gives rise to the question of transcendence. And transcendence means going beyond. It means raising further questions. We've been doing that all along in the course of the book, but now we're going to raise the question of the absolute limit in the process of going beyond. Does that process reach a limit? Is there some kind of absolute limit? Process of going beyond. As he says on 658, inquiry, insight, and formulation go beyond the content of sensible experience. Reflection, grasp of the unconditioned, and judgment go beyond objects of supposing, defining, considering to the universe of facts of being. One can go beyond knowing things as related to us, to join the scientists in searching for knowledge of things as related to one another. One can go beyond both common sense and present science to grasp the dynamic structure of our rational knowing and doing, and then formulate a metaphysics and an ethics. Finally, and this is the question for this chapter and the next, we can ask whether human knowledge is confined to the universe of proportionate being. Is human knowledge confined to mathematics, physics, chemistry, biology, psychology, cognitional theory? Or can it go beyond this realm of proportionate being to the realm of transcendent being? And this transcendent realm may be conceived either relatively or absolutely, either as beyond us or as the ultimate in the whole process of going beyond. And that's what he will reach. And he reaches God, the ultimate in the whole process of going beyond. Within the context of cognition, that ultimate limit in the process of going beyond would be the idea of being. Now, from the standpoint of religious experience, it's hard to get excited about the idea of being. That's, I mean, philosophers, and even mystic philosophers, could be excited by that. But for the rest of us, the limit in going beyond would be the limit of love, unqualified love. And that, of course, is what the way God meets us, is unqualified and unconditional love. But within the framework of cognition, this ultimate limit has to be conceived of as the idea of being. That would be the idea of everything about everything, because you couldn't go beyond that. Who could go beyond, in the realm of cognition, the idea of everything about everything? It's impossible to go beyond that. So the first step in the philosophy of God, from the standpoint of a philosophy that has been based on cognitional theory, the first step is a mental exercise whereby we extrapolate from proportionate being to think about an unrestricted act of understanding. Think about it. And to think about the idea that would be the content of that unrestricted act of understanding. The idea that would be the content of the unrestricted act is the idea of being. It's the idea that knows everything about everything, that grasps everything about everything. Extrapolation is common in mathematics. We extrapolate in mathematics to infinity, to limit. And in physics, we extrapolate, for instance, to the absolute zero of temperature. We're going beyond extrapolating mentally. So there's no reason to call it peculiar per se that we extrapolate to something that we have no experience of. We extrapolate and we think about it. Think about an unrestricted act of understanding. Moreover, we extrapolate in everyday living. We think about what we want to do with our lives. Where do you want to be 5 years from now? That's an extrapolation from where you are right now. And how am I going to get there? What steps can I take to get there? But it's a heuristic extrapolation. We think about it. We extrapolate from our past through the present to the alternative ranges of the future. Could be here, could be there, could be this, that. What do I want? How do I get there? That's an extrapolation. In the present situation, it's imagining and understanding and affirming something that isn't yet, but that perhaps might be. So we do it regularly in the realm of common sense. Even we accept one alternative, and then we take the steps to get there. We can extrapolate not only to future recurrences of past events, but also to future higher integrations. It's not like everything's got to repeat itself. It's always got to be just the way it always was. We know that that's not the case. We know it can be different. We know that changes can be introduced. We don't have to keep making the same mistakes, and so on and so forth. And so we extrapolate to future, better ways of doing things, and we say, how are we going to do it? So we're used to that. So what he's asking us to do here is to extrapolate to an unrestricted act of understanding. Whose content is the idea of being. If the ultimate limit in the process... excuse me. You'll have to be patient with me. I'm getting a little cold. If the ultimate limit in the process of going beyond is the idea of being, the imminent source of cognitive transcendence is the pure desire to know. What matches this is that we have an unrestricted desire in ourselves. We don't know the unrestricted act of understanding. None of us claims, I hope, to know everything about everything. But we have an unrestricted desire, and so it's from that unrestricted desire that we can extrapolate to the unrestricted act. What would it be like if that unrestricted desire were satisfied? So that we didn't have any further questions, and we just were in awe before the whole thing. This desire is unrestricted. That doesn't mean that our understanding is unrestricted, or that the correctness of even the understanding that we have is unrestricted. Nor does it mean that the attainment of understanding will ever be unrestricted on our part. Nor does it mean that in a wisely ordered universe, the attainment of understanding even ought to be unrestricted. Maybe it wouldn't be a good thing. Maybe it's a good thing that we keep moving on. desire for attainment does not entail exigence for attainment. Unless, and this is the point with the whole business of the obediential potency for God, desire for attainment does not entail a demand for attainment. Unless our universe is one of static horizontal strata, that Largan in some of his articles makes a big point over this, between the difference between the static conceptualist universe, static strata, physics, chemistry, biology, and the dynamic universe where one level goes right into the next. At any given level, you've got a horizontal finality. So that at that level, at the physical level, or at the chemical level, the biological, the psychological level, a desire for attainment can mean an exigence for attainment. Right? Biologically, we not only need desire, food, and sleep, and so on and so forth, but we have a right to claim that at that level. But in the world of vertical finality, there may be a tendency upwards from the physical to the chemical to the biological to the psychological to the spiritual, but that doesn't mean that striving upwards is going to be achieved or has to be achieved. So we might desire to know everything about everything, but that doesn't mean we have any right on our part ever to be given the gift of knowing everything about everything. Or we may have a desire for complete freedom, we may have a desire for God, but that doesn't mean that God has an absolute exigence to satisfy that desire. Desire for attainment does not entail exigence for attainment. Except if you think of the universe this way, that these levels are cut off from each other and the only finality is horizontal. But when you're thinking of a universe with vertical finality, that doesn't mean that the aspirations of the lower have to be satisfied. It's just that they may be satisfied. So to say that the desire is unrestricted is simply to say that we want to understand completely, that no question whatever is to be met arbitrarily, that every question is to be submitted to the process of intelligent grasp and critical reflection. It's an exigence on our part to be honest in facing the question. But it doesn't mean that all of those questions are necessarily going to be answered. The objective also of the desire is unrestricted. There's also an unrestricted objective because it's being. And being is everything about everything. So there are no restrictions placed on it. Apart from being, there is nothing. So a desire with an unrestricted objective is an unrestricted desire. That's what we have. We can identify the unrestricted desire, and from that we can extrapolate. What would it be if that were satisfied? That would be the unrestricted act. So we're concerned now with human knowledge of transcendent being. What can human beings know about being that does not lie within the domain, that's a typo there, within the domain of our outer and inner experience? There are no data on God, as there are data on the physical, chemical, biological, psychological. The only data on God that we have are the data that God provides in terms of grace and the grace of recognizing God's presence in creation and so on and so forth. But otherwise, there are no data that are given in the same way that the physical, chemical, biological, psychological, and so on are given. Before we can grasp transcendent being intelligently, we have to extrapolate from proportionate being. The extrapolation is concerned with concepts about transcendent being. So we're supposing, we're defining, we're considering. We're not yet claiming, affirming that God exists. Let's just think about it. What would this be? What would it be if there were an unrestricted act of understanding? That unrestricted act of understanding would be able to answer the question, what is being? And not answering it in a heuristic way, Being is the objective of the desire to know. Being is what we all want to know. But what is it in all of its details, all of its concrete details? That unrestricted act of understanding would be able to tell you everything about everything. That's what an unrestricted act of understanding would be capable of doing. So what is being? That's the question that leads to the extrapolation. God can answer that question. If God exists, God can answer the question. An unrestricted act of understanding can answer that question. So, we have the pure notion of being, that's the unrestricted desire. We have the heuristic notion of being. Being is whatever is to be known by intelligent grasp and critical reflection. We have restricted acts of understanding. And then we can, from all of those, we can consider the unrestricted act of understanding, which understands the being. Doesn't simply affirm this is and that is and understands just this and just that, but understands everything about everything. So number six, the pure notion of being is the detached, disinterested, unrestricted desire to know. That becomes a little bit more filled out when you think of it in the heuristic terms of whatever is to be grasped intelligently and affirmed reasonably. That's what is being. The pure desire, precisely as intelligent and reasonable, restricts itself to one question at a time. And so there are restricted inquiries, restricted acts of understanding and conceiving, reflection on such conceptions, and judgments about particular beings and particular domains of being. That's what we've been seeing through this whole book. But only an unrestricted act of understanding can meet the issue, what is the whole thing? What is being? Knowledge of what being is cannot be had in anything less than an act of understanding everything about everything. Only the content of an unrestricted act of understanding can be the idea of being. The idea of being is the content of an unrestricted act of understanding, and the idea of being is absolutely, not relatively, transcendent. It assigns the ultimate limit cognitively in the process of going beyond. So cognitively, to think about the idea of being would be equivalent to religiously being in love with the absolute creator and end of all things. So we have that experience. Cognitively, this would be the equivalent of that. It would be the intellect reaching its fulfillment. And all we can do to answer that question, what is the idea of being, is to set up heuristic procedures whereby we can say, what would we know if we did grasp it? And that's the extrapolation, proceeding on the side of the subject from restricted to unrestricted understanding, and on the side of the object from the structure of proportion of being to the transcendent idea of being. All right, let me pause there and just see if you're with me in terms of exactly what he's doing. It's a mental exercise of extrapolating to what this would be. Then he will ask, well, does this exist? For the moment, he's just considering it. Any issues you need to raise? Okay. First then, since an idea is the content of an act of understanding, and since being is the objective of the unrestricted desire to know, the idea of being, as we've seen already, is the content of an unrestricted act of understanding. Next, apart from being, there is nothing. So the idea of being is the content of an act of understanding that leaves nothing to be understood. No further questions to be asked. And so it is absolutely transcendent, the absolute limit in the process of going beyond. If there is an unrestricted act of understanding, that act of understanding doesn't ask any questions. It has no afterthoughts. Nothing is left to be understood. Nothing is indistinct. Nothing is not clear. Next, being is completely universal and completely concrete. So the idea of being is the content of an act of understanding that grasps everything about everything, with nothing implicit or obscure or indistinct, because then there would be further questions. Being is intrinsically intelligible, what can be intelligently grasped and reasonably affirmed. And so the idea of being is the idea of the total range of intelligibility. The good is identical with intelligibility, and so the idea of being is the idea of the good. The unrestricted act is one act. If it were many, they would be related intelligibly, or not. If they were, they would be intelligibly one, and so one idea. And if not, there would not be one act, but many. But we've seen that the unrestricted act is one act. So the idea of being is one idea that grasps everything. Next, however, the idea of being is one idea, but it's an idea of many things, because there's not just one being. It's immaterial, because it's intrinsically independent of the empirical residue, but it's an idea that includes the material, because it's unrestricted. Similarly, it's non-temporal. It doesn't develop, because the only way an idea develops is by asking further questions. But it includes a knowledge of the temporal, and it's non-spatial, but it includes a knowledge of the spatial. So there is a distinction that can be drawn between a primary and a secondary component in the idea of being. Primary component, you see, is the idea of being itself, the unrestricted act itself. I better take this step by step. Primary and the secondary component. For the one, it's one idea, but it's of many. It's immaterial, but it's of the material. It's non-temporal, but it's of the temporal. It's non-spatial, but it's of the spatial. The one is not identical with the many, nor the immaterial with the material, nor the non-temporal with the temporal, the non-spatial with the spatial. So, because in the one idea there are grasped many beings, because in the immaterial, non-temporal, non-spatial idea there are grasped the material, the temporal, and the spatial, there must be a primary component grasped in as much as there is a single act, and a secondary component grasped in as much as the primary component is understood. So the total range of being is understood in as much as the one idea is understood. The analogy here is the analogy that Lonergan set up in the introduction to the book. Thoroughly understand what it is to understand. And not only will you understand the broad outlines of all there is to be understood, but you will possess a fixed base and an invariant pattern opening upon further developments of understanding. That's the human analogy to what he's talking about with divine knowledge. If we understand what it is to understand, primary component in our philosophical element, we will understand the broad outlines of all that is to be understood, potency form act, secondary component in our philosophical knowledge. So that's an analogy for God. If God understands God's own act, God understands everything that is known in that act. By understanding God's own act, God understands everything that God knows in that act. So there is an analogy with our philosophical knowledge. Thoroughly understand what it is to understand, and you will understand the broad outlines of all there is to be understood. So that's the human analog for divine knowledge. If God understands God's own act of understanding, God understands everything that is known by that act of understanding. So the primary component is the unrestricted act itself, and the secondary component is everything that the unrestricted act knows. So again, he says, approach the question from the standpoint of the notion of intelligible. Intelligible denotes, number one, what is or can be understood. But secondly, more profoundly, it denotes the primary component in an idea, the root or ground of what can be understood. So you can understand, here too, metaphysics has been approached in the course of history, but for instance, by Aristotle and Thomas. What for Lonergan is the secondary component of philosophical knowledge, that can be grasped without grasping what understanding is, can be. But if you grasp what understanding is, you have a much more critical and comprehensive and grounded understanding of the broad outlines of all that is to be understood. So too, in this case, what is or can be understood, number one, that can be understood without understanding understanding. But, number two, the root or ground is an understanding, is identical with the understanding, and so cannot be understood without understanding understanding. We'll do that very clearly. Let's take the rest of this number here. The primary component in the idea of being is the unrestricted act of understanding. If the unrestricted act of understanding understands itself, then it will understand everything that it understands. If an unrestricted act is unrestricted, it understands understanding. It understands not only restricted acts, but also the unrestricted act of understanding. Understanding the unrestricted act, it must understand its content, because otherwise it wouldn't be unrestricted. But its content is the idea of being, everything about everything. So if the unrestricted act understands itself, primary component, it thereby understands everything else, secondary component. So this, the secondary component is the divine ideas, all of it's everything that God knows other than God. And God knows everything else by knowing God. Yes, Chris.
So the secondary act is the idea of being.
The whole thing.
The secondary component.
The whole thing is the idea of being. It's everything. These are the two components in the idea of being.
What? The unrestricted act of understanding.
The primary component in its what it knows, its idea, is itself. The primary component in God's knowledge, from the standpoint of the object of God's knowledge, is God. And the secondary component is everything that God knows, in knowing God, in knowing self, in knowing God's self. We're not yet into any kind of Christian revelation here at all. It's much easier for us to, at least if you're into it, talk in Trinitarian language. We can't do that. Because all of these things in Trinitarian language are known in the divine word. Yeah, the act of understanding gives rise to the divine word, and it's in the word that everything else is known. But this is more abstract.
I guess I'm just getting hung up on... Well, I'm a bit unprepared after our St. Patty's Day. Best of all, I wasn't able to prepare for today's class, so... But I'm getting a bit caught up on the distinction between an unrestricted act of understanding the content of that act.
Yeah. It's the primary content is the act itself. It's like thoroughly understand what it is to understand.
Yes.
And you will understand the broad outlines of all there is to be understood. So if you understand your own act of understanding,
yes.
the better you understand that, the better you will understand everything that it understands. So too with God. God understands God's self first as unrestricted act of understanding. And in understanding the unrestricted act of understanding, God understands everything with the unrestricted act of understanding.
So there's like this extreme reflexivity.
That's right.
That's like mystery. I mean, that's right. An unrestricted act of understanding that
that's
understands
right.
itself as an unrestricted understanding.
That's right. That's it. Yeah. That's it. You got it.
Mm.
Even after St. Patrick's Day.
I mean, because of St. Patrick's
Day.
Yeah, right. Not it.
I know this is a theological question, and it's especially if you, instead of using the word knows, you use the word love.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, God loves everything by loving God's self.
Yeah.
Does that would that lead to God being necessarily Trinitarian? And by that I mean God being necessarily more than one person.
You can't, not necessarily. I mean, God is necessarily Trinitarian because everything in God is necessary. But we cannot, from our standpoint, we cannot demonstrate that God must be Trinitarian.
Okay.
We only know that by revelation. So.
All we can say is God, he is Trinitarian.
Yes. Yeah, but not must be. There's two. Well, from the side of God, you know, there's no contingency in God, and so the second and third persons in God are not contingent. They are necessary. Everything in God is necessary act, but we don't know that by our natural knowledge. We don't know that there is in God an understanding that speaks a word. And an understanding and a word that breathe love. We don't know that, or that God must be that. We know that God is, what we can know philosophically. First of all, Lonergan would maintain none of this, even the philosophical, can be known outside of some kind of experience of grace. Even though it is natural knowledge, still, we're so affected by other trends and so on and so forth. The philosophy of God really is arrived at only within a context that is already permeated with the gift of God's love. I want to introduce the distinction there that in God the Trinitarian relations are necessary because everything is necessary in God. The Father didn't decide to speak a word and freely decide. If that were the case, the word would be a creature. It would be contingent, and we'd be Arians. It's a necessary. God is what God is. Now, someone once sent Lonergan a postcard or a letter. The postcard was inside an envelope, and the letter said, "I want you to write one word on this postcard and send it back to me. Do we make any difference to God?" And in other words, not does God love us? I mean, that's we know that, but is there any change in God, is what he meant, because of us? So the letter went back, the postcard went back, no. And a week later, another postcard arrived. We make an eternal difference to God. So that God is eternally what God is, because eternally there is the divine decision to create the world and to send the incarnate word and so on. So, yeah, it's big, it's deep, it's very deep theology. We make an eternal difference. God is eternally what God is because from eternity God has freely chosen to create this world. So, it's a biggie.
So we make no difference philosophically?
There's no change in God that takes place because human beings have made mistakes and need to be redeemed and so on and so forth. But God is eternally what God is because this is the world that from eternity God decided to create and decided to relate to in the way that God has decided to relate to it. So it's an eternal decision. And that makes God from eternity what God is. Now does that mean that makes God from eternity Father, Son, and Spirit? I don't think, but it does mean that from eternity it was decreed that the Word would become flesh and live among us, and that the Spirit would be poured into our hearts as a first fruits of the Son's victory and a pledge of everlasting life, and so on. So it's a big it's a deep statement. You know, and from both of those statements are true. From one standpoint, no, we don't. But from another standpoint, God is eternally what God is because it is God's free decision from eternity to be involved with this world in such a way. So, that's quite profound. Okay? Did I satisfactorily respond? The necessity thing is that, you know, we cannot prove that God is Trinitarian. And then from that standpoint, we can't talk about necessity. On the other hand, everything in God is necessary. Nothing is contingent. And then that, from that standpoint, God is necessarily speaker, word, and spirit of love. Okay. So, 18. Instead of the primary and secondary components, then, distinguish a primary and secondary intelligible. The primary intelligible in the idea of being is the unrestricted act of understanding itself. Secondary intelligibles are what also are grasped inasmuch as the unrestricted act understands itself, namely everything else. The existence of the non-systematic does not render this impossible, because from the viewpoint of unrestricted understanding, the non-systematic, he uses the term vanishes here, and I'm not sure that that's the complete, the best word, because it doesn't matter. It's non-systematic. But it's not a problem. It's not a problem if you've got a non-temporal, and in a moment we'll see eternal act, grasping all this diverging series of conditions. For us, we can't grasp them all. Okay. Even as we saw at the beginning of the book, in principle, if we had unlimited amounts of time, we could determine what was going to happen, and even in these diverging sets of conditions that we call the non-systematic. That's not a problem for God, because in God you've got the one eternal act that is now and sees everything and knows everything in the now. So it would vanish as a problem for us if we had an unlimited period of time to determine all the many diverging sets of conditions. For concrete patterns of diverging series of scattering conditions are each intelligible. But the unrestricted act is non-temporal, yet it knows all the temporal conditions, for it understands everything about everything. All right, so that's what it would be. That's the extrapolation. Next, does the unrestricted act of understanding exist? Is there any such thing as this act of understanding? And the answer to that question emerges by adding to what we have already seen, an understanding of causality. I think in terms of this chapter, and I think Fred Crowe is in agreement with me on this, that it's section 8 on causality, where the actual argument for the existence of God appears. And section 10, which has that famous syllogism, is simply giving you the form of all valid philosophical arguments for God's existence. But I think the argument itself is presented in the section 8 of the chapter on causality. So does the unrestricted act of understanding exist? I think we can probably take, well, we're not going to be able to do it all before a break, but we'll take some of it anyway. The answer to the question emerges by adding to what we've already seen an understanding of causality. Causes can be either external or internal. Internal causes are what we've already seen, central and conjugate potency form and act. External causes, external to any reality, are efficient, what made it, final, what for, an exemplary on what basis or what idea. If these principles of external causality have a general validity in being, so they're not simply principles that we use to talk about the world that we know. You want to build a bridge over a river. Well, the engineers come up with the plan. That's the exemplary cause. And then whoever it is builds it, and they're the efficient cause. And the final cause is that people can cross over. All right, that gives you a general idea of efficient, final, and exemplary causality. But are those ideas limited to this world? And so are they anthropomorphic? If we tried to extend them to God, would it be anthropomorphic? Or do they have a general validity in being? If they have a general validity in being, he says, then we will be led sooner or later to affirm a first agent of everything, a last end of everything, so a first agent, an efficient cause, a last end, a final cause, and a primary exemplar, which would be the secondary ideas, secondary intelligibles in God's knowledge, primary exemplar, of the universe of proportionate being, to identify the efficient and final cause with the unrestricted act of understanding and the exemplary cause with the idea of being that is the content of the unrestricted act. So really, it's everything here. The antidemocratic clause is both primary and secondary components. All right, so the principles, he says, of external causality, efficient causality, final causality, exemplary causality. Think of it in these ways. In these, you want to create a song, and you are the efficient cause of that song. The exemplary cause would be the pattern that you've got in mind that you want to put into the song. And the final cause is, you know, you want to enjoy this, or you want other people to enjoy it. Why are you doing it? So those principles of efficient, exemplary, and final causality are of general validity. And he argues it in the following four steps. Number one, being is intelligible. Being is what is to be known by intelligent grasp and reasonable affirmation. Number two, what is apart from being is nothing. And so what is apart from intelligibility is nothing. So number three, there can be no mere matters of fact without explanation, if it is true that being is intelligible. Then there can be no mere matters of fact without explanation. If existence is mere matter of fact, it is nothing. If occurrence is mere matter of fact, it is nothing. If it is a mere matter of fact that we know and that there are to be known classical and statistical laws, genetic operators, dialectical perturbations, explanatory gender and species, emergent probability, and upward finalistic dynamism, if it's mere matter of fact, then this whole book is nothing. Everything that he's been talking about, the knowing and the known are nothing, if it's mere matter of fact without explanation. Why is there being rather than nothing? Question that Heidegger raises and that Leibniz raised. One cannot confine human knowledge within the domain of proportion of being without condemning it to mere matters of fact without explanation, and so stripping it of knowledge not only of transcendent but also of proportion of being. Why? Because we do not know until we judge. Our judgments rest on a grasp of the virtually unconditioned. And the virtually unconditioned is a condition that happens to have its conditions fulfilled. If that happening is not to be mere matter of fact without explanation, and so nothing, a further question arises. So to every proportionate being, all of us, everything in this room, everything that we've ever run into, is in its every aspect a virtually unconditioned. It doesn't have to be. Its conditions happen to be fulfilled. If that happening is ultimate, it is a mere matter of fact without explanation. Because you could say, well, what was the reason for those causes? And so on and so forth. And so either it is not being, and so nothing, or being is not intelligible. And then you've got to take back three quarters of the book up to this point. So knowledge of transcendent being can be excluded if there is proportionate being. It cannot be excluded. If there is proportionate being, if being is intelligible, this transcendent being must not be contingent in any respect. For again, if it were, then there would be mere matter of fact without explanation. And this transcendent being must be able to ground the explanation of everything about everything, or else it would leave unsolved the problem of contingence in proportionate being. So if we follow the argument in the book up to this point, then what he's arguing here is that ultimately the universe cannot be arbitrary. There cannot be an ultimate arbitrariness if, in fact, being is intelligible. Then there must be some first cause responsible for its existence. Why is there being rather than nothing? There can't be. If being is intelligible, then there cannot be anything that is simply a mere matter of fact without explanation. And existence cannot be, the problem of existence, occurrence, cannot be answered by the sciences. The sciences can answer the question, what exists? But not why there is anything that exists and not nothing that exists. Okay? Following? argument. So it's in that kind of grounding that we grasp the general validity of external causality. Efficient causality, which is the big one, I think, in these arguments, and certainly in Thomas's argument for God's existence. I'm going to have to take a break in a moment so I can refresh my voice box. But efficient causality does not consist simply in the necessity that conditioned being becomes virtually unconditioned only if its conditions are fulfilled. Because the question is, well, what about, why are those conditions fulfilled? Why are the conditions for that fulfilled, and so on? The real requirement is that if conditioned being is, it has to be intelligible and cannot be or exist or occur merely as matter of fact without explanation, because then ultimately the existence of it is unintelligible. Infinite regress and schemes of recurrence do not meet this requirement because they are aggregates of mere matters of fact. And so they don't assign an efficient cause for intelligible but conditioned being. So only a being without any conditions that can ground the fulfillment of conditions for everything else will do. So if being is intelligible, there must be transcendent being without any conditions. Otherwise, being is not intelligible. Proportionate being exists, and if it is intelligible, there must be such an unconditioned being. And if there are conditioned beings, exemplary causality, there's also the fulfilling of their conditions. And if there are no mere matters of fact without explanation, conditions cannot be fulfilled simply at random. There has to be some exemplar, some reason, some understanding for the fulfillment for everything. When people say nothing happens without a reason, that's what they're getting at, right? And in the community of sufferers that I've known through my own work with AIDS patients, some of them have come to this as a spiritual insight, that nothing has happened without some reason, even this. Right? And what they've grasped in this, that there is no mere matter of fact without explanation. Conditions are not fulfilled simply at random, but in accord with some kind of idea of the universal condition of fulfillment of conditions in the universe. The idea of being is the content of an unrestricted act of understanding. The unrestricted act is itself the primary intelligible in the idea of being. So there must be an exemplary cause. The divine unrestricted act in its knowing of the idea of being. That as idea of being can ground the intelligibility of the pattern of the conditions, the fulfillment of the conditions for everything else. And that would be the idea of being as the content of an unrestricted act of understanding. So again, that unrestricted act must exist if being is intelligible. And if that exists, then complete intelligibility exists. It exists in the idea of being. The intelligibility that is the root or ground or key of intelligibility in the ordinary sense. The act of understanding understands everything about everything, why everything has happened, and so on. And finally, final causality. If there's one actual order of the universe, and if it stands within being and so is intelligible and not mere matter of fact, then it is of value, it is a good, and it is the object of a rational and free choice. So here, in the acknowledgement that the universe emerges from a rational and free choice on the part of the unrestricted act of understanding, God freely choosing to create this world, contingents and arbitrariness are overcome at their deepest level, if it is the case. So there's an awful lot here. You can see that it would be very difficult without some kind of religious experience to grant. There are a lot of people for whom this universe is basically a hostile environment and is not a value in the object of a rational and free choice. So the argument here is counterintuitive for a number of people, and I think that has to be admitted. That's why I think he said he should have begun the chapter by talking about the experience of grace, unique experience. So let's just do the summary and then we'll take the break. To summarize the argument then, and that takes us through section 8 of chapter 19. If the real is being, and being is completely intelligible, there must exist a transcendent being that is not contingent in any respect. and that is capable of grounding the explanation of everything about everything. And the unrestricted act of understanding alone meets these specifications, and so it must exist. And then in the next two sections, that unrestricted act of understanding will be identified with God. It's in St. Thomas, and hoc est quod omnes vocant Deum. So Thomas argues for something along the same lines as what Lonergan has been arguing, and then he says, and that's what everybody calls God. And that's what we'll see in the sections 9 and 10. So, but what he's argued to already is the hoc. This is what everybody calls God. Any questions before we pray? About the argument, the validity of it, or anything? Okay, let's pray.